Welcome to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. Jim and I are here again. And we're here with Edward Keenan. Oh, you know what? I just pulled your bio out of your book. Do you mind if I read that?
No, that's fine. Okay, that's absolutely good.
Edward Keenan has been writing about Toronto's politics and culture for over 10 years, and most recently a senior editor at The Grid, Where We Are. Thank you for letting us be here. And a columnist at Spacey Magazine. He's a 9-time National Magazine Award finalist and was shortlisted for Best Blogger at the 2012 Canadian Online Publishing Awards. He serves on the faculty of the Academy of the Impossible, which I want to hear more about, and coaches a children's hockey team. He lives in the Junction with his wife Rebecca and their 3 children. And he's just written a book called Some Great Idea, which Jim and I have both enjoyed, and we're going to talk about today. Welcome.
Well, yes, thank you for having me.
All right.
And welcome to The Grid.
Thank you. So, Jim, you want to start?
Well, why don't you start off by telling us how you came to immerse yourself in the history and politics of Toronto?
It's an interesting question because it was never really a conscious decision. I grew up in Toronto. My parents grew up in Toronto. Some of my grandparents grew up in Toronto. So I guess growing up, I had a real sense of this place being my home, and just hearing stories from the people around me about the evolution of the places near where we lived, places we see. I also had the kind of father who would, you know, sort of pull the car over to look at every roadside monument or memorial or plaque and, you know, sort of explain his understanding of the history. And so then, you know, through high school and university, I was really interested in being a writer and in writing and telling stories. But I hadn't ever thought that city politics or the city of Toronto would become my main subject, which it has over the past few years. What happened instead is that when I first started working, especially at iWeekly, there were jobs like covering committee meetings at City Hall that nobody wanted, and I was willing to take them because I wanted the work. I wanted to develop as a journalist, and so while I was there, you know, you start to learn more and need to learn more. A lot of the little things I had heard over the years would suddenly seem like they might be useful, so I'd go back and look up more information about them. And throughout all of that, I was really just trying to find a way to make a lot of the boring political stories about City Hall interesting. And so I'd be looking for stories about neighborhoods, a little bit of history, a little bit of background to try and provide some bigger context, or something about this, you know, this place that I kind of grew up loving.
What year was that you started?
I started at iWeekly in 2002. And so then now I've been at that for 10 years. And you know, it sort of came with the job. There were 2 things happened at once, I guess, too, which was that as I was doing that job and having to do a lot of that research and finding out these stories and just hearing them from people, when I would go to write about a political movement or a new civic center or community space that was opening, or even when I was writing about local artists, I would go and ask them questions that would then... they'd start telling me the history of this space they were in or this project they were involved in, or they would be mentioning the people that got them involved in it, and certain names come up again and again. And so it sort of was the air I was breathing at that time. And at the same time, I sort of had a process, like a lot of other people, I think, in the mid-2000s, the first decade of the millennium, of sort of falling back in love with the city a bit and feeling like something exciting was going on here.
Did you feel you were part of that and part of a group that was part of that?
I think so. I definitely felt like I was part of a group that was part of something, although I always sort of felt like I was on the outside of the group or just at the fringe of it, because a lot of how I was involved in it was to write about it. But between sort of Spacing Magazine and then a lot of affiliated, which is a magazine sort of about public spaces in Toronto and celebrating, you know, almost like urban planning subjects and things like that in Toronto, and the Toronto Public Space Committee, which was a sort of a semi-affiliated group that was lobbying at City Hall, but also a lot of the other different political groups that sort of had backed, and then some of them who then later sort of turned on David Miller, but the group around there. But then also this real arts and music community that seemed to be having a bit of a renaissance at the same time. And I felt like, as a writer for I Weekly, I was positioned in a place where I was constantly getting to write about these things, and by being sort of this chronicler of it, one of, you know, several, but that I was a part of it. And sometimes I was more actively a part of it than others, but... Yeah.
Well, your book focuses primarily on the post-inauguration years.
It does, yeah.
But to get us there, you identify three major figures from Toronto's past that give us an indication of how we can understand how the city came to be in its current form. So you can tell us a little bit about those figures and why you chose them.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was trying to look at how to understand post-amalgamation Toronto, I was kind of trying to develop a bit of a theory of Toronto, trying to, you know, in the sense that you have an image in your mind of what San Francisco is about or what New York is about, like what characteristics define that city, what things have led to whatever's happening now. And I felt like the story of Toronto is a little bit hazier, mm-hmm. And a little less understood. And so I was looking at several things in the history. And one of those things was, you know, that we have been a city throughout Toronto's history that was always growing. There's almost always been as many or more newcomers to the city, either first or second generation immigrants to the city, as there were people who lived here before that, from the very beginning of Toronto as an idea. And sort of this little piece of mythology that the word Toronto means meeting place, which it probably doesn't actually mean that, but sort of sums that up a little bit, right? Like, this is a place where we're constantly changing and evolving and adding new people, and those people contribute something new onto the base that already exists. That said, the base that already exists now, I think, three figures, and it's a really selective reading of Toronto history. There could be a lot more figures, but the three that come up again and again and again in the work I do as sort of reference, people who've taken inspiration from these people in the past, are William Lyon Mackenzie, who was the first mayor of Toronto. He was a reformer from the very beginning, campaigning against the ruling elite of the city. He coined the term family compact in his newspaper, The Colonial Advocate, that he published. And it really was largely a family. Like, these were people who really were related to each other and very, very close friends. But they ran all of, you know, not just the city, but the province at the time, through Upper Canada. So, you know, he ran for mayor of Toronto on a sort of a reform, throw the bums out platform, and became the very first mayor, you know, as the city was incorporated. And then after he was mayor, he served in the legislature, the provincial legislature, and then led an armed rebellion that was put down quickly. He was exiled after that. Mm-hmm. But later he was allowed back into the country, and he was elected to the Parliament of Canada. And quite a lot of the ideas that were behind his revolution, behind his political reform career, became sort of founding ideas of Canadian democracy. He was really in favor of expanding to the vote to an ever larger group of people, new immigrants. He was in favor of getting rid of sort of religious influence on government, which was then exercised, you know, by the Church of England very much. Cutting the sort of royal ties or colonial ties that at that time meant that you get power and influence in the city based on who you're related to or who you know. And I think, you know, that spirit informs a lot of the things that have happened through Toronto since then, of ever more democracy and mistrust of elites. Then R.C. Harris, and again, he's not unique, but in terms of there are figures, similar figures in other cities, but in Toronto, again, as a defining figure, Roland Caldwell Harris was a bureaucrat. He was actually born and raised inside the City Hall building as a young man, because his mother was a cleaner there, I think. He was a works commissioner in the post-war era for about 35 years, actually, after the First World War, I think. As a influential civil servant, he sort of disbanded a lot of corrupt private transit operators, streetcar operators that existed at the time, and amalgamated those services together into the precursor of the TTC. He came into office at a time when the infant mortality rate was sky high. The cities were running with sewage. We had no proper sewage system, no water sanitation system that worked. Because at that time, again, the population had exploded. It had doubled, more than doubled, in a period of 10 years. And the city didn't have infrastructure to deal with that. So, you know, within 10 years of being in office, actually faster than that, he built the sewer infrastructure we needed. He put in all kinds of water sanitation. The infectious disease rate went way down. He built sidewalks, lots and lots of sidewalks all over the city. We take that sort of thing for granted now. But he also built roads out into what were then the far reaches of the suburbs, you know, the Mount Pleasant and Bayview and whatnot. These are roads that he constructed. Almost all the bridges that still exist in Toronto today were constructed under R.C. Harris's watch, including, notably, and probably he's most famous for, the Bloor Viaduct, which, connected the east and west sections of the city. At the time, the east section on the other side of the Don River was very sparsely populated. It was barely part of Toronto, really. Crossing the Don Valley was a huge challenge, and the Bloor Viaduct was a huge project, but he oversaw it personally, championed it. He worked with the architect and the designer to make a beautiful sort of, or what he thought was beautiful anyway, steel arch design that now defines the vista of the Don Valley, if you look over it. And he also insisted on roughing in, at great cost actually, roughing in subway tunnels underneath the bridge, even though we wouldn't have a subway at all for another several decades after that.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
No subway at all, never mind no subway along Bloor Danforth, which mm-hmm. came even later. And so we're still using that infrastructure that he built. And he built it not for the city that was. He sort of came into office in a city that had, the population had overgrown the existing resources so quickly. But he didn't just build to catch up. He built for the city of the future, such that 100 years from then, the city we live in is still relies on a ton of the infrastructure he built. And I think that spirit that the city needs not just democracy, which is what William Lyon Mackenzie maybe defined. And then the final of the sort of three patron saints of Torontoism, as I call them, is Jane Jacobs, who she wrote perhaps the most influential urban planning book in history, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She's also sort of influential in her writing on economics and how the economics of cities works. She was an activist and a rabble-rouser. She lived in Greenwich Village at the time when she sort of rose to prominence in New York City and wrote her book based a lot on her observations of Greenwich Village. But she moved here with her family so that her sons could avoid the Vietnam draft and lived in the annex. And sort of, she found here a city that really exemplified a lot of the, by accident almost, a lot of the principles that she was talking about, especially the old city of Toronto, what people sometimes now call downtown, but the former municipality of Toronto at the heart of the current Toronto, is this set of small neighborhoods with main strips, where people live close to places where they can work, where they can shop, where you have industry and retail and residences all in the same neighborhood, where there's sort of this uninterrupted pattern of things to do and places to go that creates a kind of what she called a sidewalk ballet, the ballet of sidewalk life, where people encounter their neighbors, encounter each other. It's life, urban life lived at sort of human scale. Sort of St. Jane is famous in urban planning circles and urbanist circles around the world now, and especially in every major city in North America. But in Toronto, when she arrived here, she had certain amount of fame for fighting Robert Moses in New York. He was a transportation commissioner there, an influential bureaucrat, and she fought an expressway plan that would have come right through Greenwich Village. And she fought a lot of slum clearance plans, which would have leveled old neighborhoods to build housing projects, right? She found the same thing was going on here. The Gardner Expressway and the Don Valley Parkway had already been built. They were the first stages of a vast expressway plan. And the next phase that was already under construction was the Spadina Expressway. What's now Allen Road, the Allen Expressway, was the beginning of the Spadina Expressway. And the next phase of it was going to bring it down south of Eglinton and through what is today the annex, what was then the annex, leveling most of it, down Spadina, right into Chinatown, what is now Chinatown. So she and her neighbors, a lot of whom were very influential or turned out to later be very influential, some of them John Sewell was a city councilor. Colin Vaughn was an architect who had done a lot of work on Expo 67. He was an immigrant from Australia, but through this sort of Spadina Expressway fight, he later became a city councilor. His son is a city councilor today. Marshall McLuhan, famous thinker Marshall McLuhan, sort of joined the fight. There are many, many others, shopkeepers, academics, but they banded together to sort of, then they formed a group to stop the Spadina Expressway and save our city, right? And they ultimately won. They fought City Hall, and they fought City Hall, and when they couldn't win at City Hall, and it looked like there was no hope, they appealed to the provincial government, and Bill Davis, who was a conservative premier at the time, finally stood up in the legislature and announced that the Spadina Expressway construction would be halted exactly where it was, and his line, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing from memory, but he said something to the effect that if we were going to build a city for cars, this would be a good place to start. But if we're building a city for people, this is a good place to stop. And they did stop. The Scarborough Expressway was never built. Another expressway that was going to come down through the junction along Keele Street, where High Park is now, was stopped. That helped define how the city developed. But an interesting thing out of that movement, as I've hinted, some of these people became more and more politically influential, is that fighting that expressway led to the articulation of a whole bunch of principles and a community of people who was already active now in fighting for those principles. And so they turned that fight after they won into a political movement that, elected a reform council in the 70s that was led by David Crombie. It led through the 70s, and then, David Crombie followed by John Sewell. And that reform council is largely recognized as it was at the time, and it is today, as a sort of a renaissance in Toronto. They did some controversial things. They declared a moratorium on building tall buildings for a while. I think it was just a year or maybe 2 years. But through that, then they articulated a lot of very specific building guidelines and principles. They built affordable housing co-ops like the St. Lawrence Market neighborhood, which didn't exist before then at all. It was industrial land. This is a time when sort of Harper's Magazine wrote a huge story about Toronto. New York at the time was being overrun by crime. All the people with any money at all were fleeing to the suburbs. That was happening in Detroit. It was happening in Buffalo. It was happening in Cleveland, New York City. Los Angeles is a different kind of story, but most major American cities and many Canadian cities were experiencing this sort of hollowing out, where you have this blight and crime, and in the downtown core, where nobody really lives there except maybe people who are too poor to possibly afford to go anywhere else, and you're surrounded by the suburbs, this isolation, this privacy, people driving out to the suburbs. So Toronto never had that. We didn't go through that. And a lot of the credit to that goes to, first of all, how the city was developed in the first place, but second of all, the kind of government we had through that period. And that was a result not just of Jane Jacobs' thinking, but she's a good sort of figurehead for that movement. It was in the fighting. It was in being forced by the proposed leveling of their neighborhood that they were sort of inspired to articulate positive things and build a decade-long movement to transform the city, and they did. So
we're gonna jump.
I have a tendency to ramble, so you guys just cut me off if you.
Oh, we will. Yeah. We definitely will. We're gonna jump a few decades, but first we gotta listen to the first song pick.
Oh, okay, excellent.
And did you, given where we've gotten to, which one do you wanna?
Well, the first one might be interesting in that it doesn't directly relate to exactly what we've been talking about, but it does. It's somewhat related in that I think Kensington Market is a good example of. Improvised neighborhood in Toronto. A lot of people constantly make reference to Kensington Market as their favorite neighborhood. You know, two CBC TV shows have been set there. It's the great example. But it's also because it sort of was improvised. It developed in a ramshackle way. It's very small. Generations of immigrants have transformed it in their own ways to make it this kind of magical place that you couldn't possibly plan. And his best experience on foot. So the Market Song by Kevin Quain is partly, it's set in the market, and it feels a bit like the market to me. You know, the checks came in today, so it's time to get fried. But I chose it because I love Kevin Quain. He recently ended an 18-year residency at the Cameron House, where every Sunday night his band would play, and my wife would go there and see them all the time, and the first few times we thought he sounded a bit like Tom Waits, and then after that we just forgot maybe about the shared scratchiness of his voice and just appreciated the songwriting. And I think he's like, a great sort of Toronto Queen Street West institution, and the song is kind of a tribute to a place in the city I love.
It's midnight in the market. Damn right. Full and the checks came in today. We all get Dixie fried. Tonight we're invincible millionaires out on the town with a big can of red paint. Tomorrow we're just bombs on the riverbank. The mercy, the angels and saints. You say you're no good for me, baby, but you always say that with a smile. Between you and me and the lamppost, between this living hell and the great unknown, I'm your very own Sonny Jim. I'm the devil you know. It's way past three and you're yelling at me, 'cause I keep falling down. But I've grown to love the way you push me around. Every time you look at me that way, I always forget to breathe. You always pretend not to notice streets in knee-deep in ones like me. You say you're no good for me, baby, but you always say that with a smile. Between you and me and the lamppost, between this living hell and the great unknown, I'm your very own Sonny Jim. I'm the devil you know. I'm your very own Sonny Jim. I'm the devil you know.
Okay, so welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. We're here with Edward Keenan, who has just written a book called Some Great Idea, and Jim Vernon and I are here. So, Jim, go ahead. What's your next question?
Okay, so the three figures you cited certainly give an indication of why in the early to mid-2000s you felt vibrant in the city, since with the arrival of Miller, it seems those three... Mm-hmm. Those three traits seem to be the broom and the renewal of a respect for city infrastructure and planning and a renewal of a kind of activist community built around engaging with City Hall. But the largest section of the book is dedicated to how that changed with a different reformer representing in a way a city... that may have lost some of those principles, or at least may have put some of those principles in different places or in mm-hmm. different order. And so one of the most interesting things to me about your book was that you focus on the fact that most of Rob Ford's support comes from marginalized communities. It comes from low-income, recent immigrant communities, reflecting changing demographics in the city. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the transition from a Toronto that reflected the principles mm-hmm. its great idea through its three figures and the transition that took place with Ford coming to power?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a couple premise things here that one thing was that, you know, those sort of Jane Jacobs ideas or whatever you want to call the way the old city of Toronto was built and functioned were largely true of the old city of Toronto, which was an independent municipality that was also part of the Metropolitan Toronto government. Umbrella government. Scarborough, North York, Etobicoke, and to a lesser extent York and East York had a different physical character. They were built at a different time. I spend a while in the book talking about Scarborough, which I know well because I lived there for more than a decade, which, you know, virtually the entire city of Scarborough as we know it was developed on farmland in a period of about 5 or 10 years in the very late 50s and through the 60s, and it was built on a suburban model, and the sort of the idea was that this would be a place where middle class people would move because they wanted privacy, and then they would drive to places where they could encounter community if they wanted it, and you know it's a lot of bungalows, and then there was a high rise boom at the time, so a lot of concrete high rises. And much of North York and Etobicoke is the same way. Two things happened, and one is that amalgamation meant that we were now one civic entity. There's no longer these separate identities, and so we now had parts of Toronto that were built in fundamentally different ways, served their residents in very different ways. And I really think the way you encounter the city you live in, whether on foot, in your car, you know, how long your commute is, these things really shape how you think about the city you live in, whether you like it or not, whether you feel like it's serving you well or not. And the other thing that happened is that much of the inner suburbs, which had been built on this sort of middle-class two-car garage fantasy of like sort of never meeting your neighbors except at the bowling alley at the mall, the character of the neighborhoods changed. A lot of wealthy people... decided at a certain point as a sort of a North America-wide trend that moving back downtown would be the thing, that this kind of privacy was actually isolating. And what happened in a lot of the concrete tower neighborhoods, which again were built without any sort of idea of a streetscape or a community that you'd be in, they're just vast acres of concrete and grass surrounding a giant tower in the, you know, and then, you know, two football fields away, there's another giant tower surrounded again by, you know, these alienating spaces suddenly, right? And more those spaces were inhabited by people they were not intended to serve. Recent immigrants, people who are impoverished, otherwise described as sort of at risk, right? They summed up by that term, at risk, I think, or marginalized. And now, those communities in Scarborough, in North Etobicoke, have done a lot of like really fascinating things. You go to strip malls and you find excellent food in Scarborough strip malls or in Rexdale strip malls, and like from every corner of the globe. Like the city's much talked about multiculturalism is really present there. And if you're shopping for a sari, or if you're At Cedar Bray High School, near Markham and Lawrence in Scarborough, they have a translation club where the students translate documents that are going home to parents into, like, I think it was 100 languages, the principal there told me. But, you know, so there are elements of culture there that are really great. But they don't mix together in the same way that they do in the old neighborhoods, because you don't have this encountering each other in the street. What you have is sort of a lot of places separated by great distance that you have to go to on purpose, and you meet like-minded people there. But there are also those suburban neighborhoods were not built to deliver the type of services that a lot of marginalized communities have long depended on. When I grew up in South Riverdale, before my family moved to Scarborough, I could walk to, and I did walk to, swimming lessons at three different community centers within walking distance of my house. When I was 10 years old, my 8-year-old brother and I would walk by ourselves because they were close enough that my parents felt very comfortable with that. We had a streetcar that ran right past our house. My school was less than a block from my house. There's a church there. There were settlement. There was a growing Vietnamese population there at the time, and there were settlement agencies around there. There was a huge low-income population in that part of the city at the time, in the 1970s and 60s. And there were a lot of community services built right into the neighborhood, right there. And in the suburbs, that wasn't necessarily the case. First of all, because they weren't built for a population that was expected to need that level of community services. And partly because there was an expectation that you would have a car. So there is a swimming pool, a great community center near, say, my parents' house in Scarborough. But when we say near in Scarborough, we mean it's a 20-minute drive away. And it has two ice surfaces, a giant pool, baseball diamonds, and all kinds of things you would want. But it's that far away. And if you don't have a car, it can be frustrating to get to. If you're a teenager whose parents are working late and you need to get around, there's no good public transit in those parts of the city. It really takes
You have a community that was built for the wealthy, and the wealthy decided they want to live somewhere else, so it was left for the poor.
That's right.
And now we're one big city.
And now I think it, in many ways, it's a good thing that we're one big city, because it means, you know, the kind of diversity that we have always prided ourselves on, but that's also been a real source of strength for us. It's made us a better city all the way along. That gets threatened when you get this stratification of the population. And I think amalgamation means we have one civic identity, we're all in this together. And these emergent problems, which, you know, there had been a demographic trends taking place for 10, 15 years, but the studies that sort of started to really document those were released in the early years of Miller's administration, right? Poverty by postal code was a study by the United Way that sort of flagged the growing trend towards the sort of the suburb, the inner suburbs being the new inner city, and more of an American-style inner city as we would think about it. And then David Holchansky's Three Cities Within Toronto report, which really census district by census district showed just how huge this trend was. And the result is that there are actually still quite a lot of affluent people and middle-class people in Etobicoke, in Scarborough. But if you look at it as like at a neighborhood level, what people who live there see is that some of the people who live in those neighborhoods today are really marginalized and really need services that they're not getting from the city. And that their neighborhood is not delivering to them. And their neighbors who may be more affluent, who may be still driving places, still look around their neighborhood and see that this neighborhood's been getting poorer now for 10 years that I've lived here, 15 years. Like, my neighbors are not doing as well as they used to be, right? This place is going to the dumps. And so whether you're rich or poor in that neighborhood, what you're seeing is that you're living in a community that's not thriving. And when you look downtown, because people who live, you know, in Kensington Market or Little Italy have very little occasion to ever go out to most parts of Scarborough or most parts of Etobicoke. There aren't destinations there, right? There's no club district there. There's no very few people work there.
There's really nothing there that you couldn't get in Toronto.
Exactly. There's no reason, right? Whereas people who live in Rexdale or who live in Malvern you know, they come down to see a Jays game at the Sky Dome, or they come to work every day in the downtown core, or they come down to go to the Eaton Center, right? It's like the things, the destinations are all downtown. And when you come downtown, what you see is fancy new buildings going up. People are just getting richer down here. And when you look at the demographic information, it's actually true. As much as, you know, incomes are stagnating and for the middle class as well, what you see is that neighborhoods downtown are getting richer. And, you know, at old, what used to be sort of slum strips are now all doggy spas and Starbucks's. And, you know, Starbucks is the dumpy place on a lot of blocks now, right? It's the place that you don't go to because you're too snobby, right? Like, and that, I think David Miller represented a lot of that success that was happening downtown. In people's minds as much as anything, he represented that success, that what looks what you could call gentrification of the city. Not that that was what he was trying to champion, but that's certainly the demographic that he's associated with. And I think that bred a real resentment, and I'm not sure it was an unjustified, completely, I understand the resentment. I'm not saying it's justified. I'm saying I really understand that a lot of people in the city have good reason to believe that the city's not serving them well and hasn't been.
Well, the promise that you could reduce taxes without reducing services probably still rings true to those who don't have much access to city services, since there wouldn't have been much of a service pool from which to have cuts for people who live in those areas. It would look like the promise was kept, as opposed to those who have more access to the services but less need for them.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, that's like, I think the thing is that it's not like there can be an implied snobbery in this kind of thing when I say, oh, people in the suburbs have this, you know, view of the city. But I think a lot of us can have a failure of imagination, like no matter where we live, and even very highly educated people, very intelligent people. But, you know, you sort of look around the world you live in, and you have expectations of what's reasonable to expect given that. And I think if you're in a place where your taxes have been going up and you keep hearing announcements of, like, new bike lanes being installed on Jarvis Street and, all these fancy new condominiums and we're going to build new streetcars, which is streetcars, again, is something you associate specifically with the downtown core. And in your case, the city services are really poor. It's hard to get to them if they exist at all, or even if they're worth taking the time to get to. And when we talk about investing in transit, I mean, a lot of people rightly just think that transit, for them to right now, cycling or transit or pedestrianism, are not reasonable options where they live. And the proposition, which David Miller was making, which his sort of allies who still are on council continue to embrace, and I certainly support, is actually that we can provide better transit to those areas that are poorly served by transit. It's just seeing how you get from here to there is one thing, and the idea that your money is being wasted might seem self-evidently true, because it's like, well, what does this government ever do for me? And it's hard to forget. It's easy to forget about, you know, sewage and clean water and garbage trucks, right? But, and of course, the people who drive the garbage trucks seem to be always going on strike or threatening to go on strike, right? Which, again, when we get into the philosophical and political debates about it, I think, like, there are very good reasons behind the labor struggles. But if you feel like you're not doing well and nobody around you is doing well and the service you get isn't that great anyway, it can be hard to see. And the idea that money's being wasted can seem self-evident, because I'm constantly paying more and I'm not getting any more, right?
Could you say that it is a matter of definition? Perhaps your definition or my definition?
You absolutely could. I think I have a song for that, if you wanted
amazing.
To take a break,
yes,
for a song.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. So, I chose this song, My Definition of a Boombastic Jazz Style by the Dream Warriors, for a couple reasons. But, one, it's as we record this, I'm not sure when people will be listening to it exactly, but as we record this, Quincy Jones has just been, put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there's a great... It's a sample in this song of a Quincy Jones song, but I didn't know it as a Quincy Jones sample when I heard this song. I knew it as a theme song for a Canadian game show, but it kicks ass anyway. And the other thing is that when I was living in Scarborough in 1991, this song came out, and it was the first real Toronto hip-hop song I knew, and I was a huge fan of sort of the hip-hop scene at the time, and I was so proud that there was like a song this good that was made by people in this city. And it made me imagine that we could actually, it sort of defined for me that this kind of cultural work was possible right here where I lived. So that's my definition by the Dream Warriors is still one of my favorite songs.
My definition of a boombastic jazz style. Here we go, are you ready for one another? Dream Warriors noise is new, discover all. Once again with a new blend, so telephone a friend.
Yo, Dream Warriors got this new song, it's dope, man.
Compact disc to the prime is Optimus. Fans are friends, I'm universal and cosmic. Concrete jungles abound. Stand by the speaker, you're smothered and covered up in the sound. You stand strong as you pump your fist. I'm talking all that jazz. Now what's my definition? My definition, my definition. My definition is this. My definition, my definition. My definition, my definition is this. My definition, my definition is this. My definition. Rhymes, it's often said to do damage. Skin so strong, even Superman needs a hand. So bob your head, dread, as I kick the funk flow. This rhyme is subliminal, yet you don't think so. I walk with a gold cane, a gold brain, and no gold chain. Behind the truth lies, there lies a paradox. In the mix is where Dream Warriors go. Define if you will, but I know so. There is no definition. My definition, my definition. My definition is this, my definition, my definition, my definition, my definition is this, my definition, my definition is this, my definition. Right now I know it's a flow, it just like a poet. Your definition of me is definitely wrong. Why must I try to lie and build an alibi? All you ask is just for me to be me. Replace a replaceable replacement with this. Relax, relax, relaxation, bombastic. My name is King Lou.
Mine is capital Q.
Bags of mostly water, search to find my definition. My definition, my definition. My definition is this, my definition. My definition, my definition. My definition is this, my definition. My definition is this, my definition.
So welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. We're here with Edward Keenan. Edward Keenan, wow, that's what I just said. That's exactly right. who wrote Some Great Idea. He's also the senior editor at The Grid, where we are, and he's kindly let us do the interview here. And we're hearing, is that the air system that we're hearing?
I think it likely is.
Oh, wow,
is, yeah.
I thought this whole time there's a waterfall here. I was going to say there's a nice waterfall.
Yeah, a lovely... Anyway. Well, we can see the lake through the closed blinds.
We can. So we, we've been talking about your book,
yeah.
Some Great Idea, and you've done a great job of painting the history of the city from city of Toronto as a downtown to the building of the suburbs around the outskirts, and now we are now one city with essentially very different perspectives from its citizens, from the more affluent central to the more what we call at risk in the suburbs, if you wanted to generalize.
Yeah.
So what Jim and I were thinking, oh, and Jim's here too.
Welcome back, Jim.
We'd like to talk a bit about now what is coming down the road in terms of what are the next steps or what's the future of Toronto as one big mega city? How does it reconcile itself?
Well, this is where we get to sort of the realm a bit of hope, right? And you know, Some Great Idea is the title of the book, but my ideas of what should happen or could happen or what I hope will happen. But I think some of the ingredients are there, right? Because one thing that's happened now is that Rob Ford has come and he's sort of stopped the gravy train slash and burn agenda has done two things. First of all, it sort of demonstrated that there wasn't that much gravy there in the first place. He didn't find the savings. So now we're at a stage now where Rob Ford keeps acknowledging we need more revenue, and it's got to come from casinos or it's got to come from, you know, something. But it's like they're just not fat to cut, right? And that's become obvious. But also, he has sort of uniquely inspired a backlash that can turn into a movement. He galvanized people by threatening to cut services, and they came out to defend them. And it was so many different services, all in so many different corners of the city, that it activated a lot of different people who don't necessarily always talk to each other. The other thing, though, is that because we have this sort of suburban-urban, for lack of a better word, divide in Toronto in who voted for Rob Ford or who supported any given issue, that difference in perspective has come right to the forefront. It's something we have to talk about now, and we have been talking about a lot. I'm not sure it's always been in the healthiest ways, but sometimes we get towards it, like in the case of the transit battle. I think David Miller's Transit City Plan was a good idea. A lot of other people that I thought it was a good idea, but we didn't really have a debate about it. It was just sort of like Miller kind of presented the plan, the province said, yeah, we'll give you some money for it, and then it was just kind of quietly going ahead. And this is $8 billion, right? So Rob Ford said, no, we're going to put all that money into one little stub of a subway, I'll bury the Eglinton line and subways, which, finally that was undone by just like reality, by math, by his subway was never going to be built, right? His Shepherd subway. It's just, there was no money to pay for it. But we were forced as a city to have this giant debate. We had to talk about it. And now people really are way more informed about transit planning and the transit plans we have and what's possible and what's, practical than they ever did before Rob Ford. We would never have had that debate. We would never have had any sort of great understanding, and we would never have had city council have the vote, and have a majority vote in favor of the transit plan we have without Rob Ford.
One of the arguments in your book is that that's really what the power of the mayor is in the city.
I mean, he kind of controls the agenda, and we have a debate about that agenda. And in your ideal world or my ideal world, I agree with the person controlling the agenda, and when they talk about an issue and we all debate it, that's because we want to get behind the mayor's vision. But it can also work in reverse, where the mayor's articulating a vision, that becomes the agenda, and I'm opposed to that, but still I'm glad we're talking about some of these issues, right? And I think some of those figures we talked about, democracy, is certainly like the most important thing, is like getting as many voices as we can, and especially those voices of people who may be Rob Ford supporters, but or maybe live in parts of the city that supported Rob Ford, getting them involved, actively involved in the democracy, I think is a really important part of this, because we need to talk to each other. Infrastructure, like a lot of the problems we just talked about the suburbs, and a lot of the problems that I think have inspired people to have such a negative view of the city that leads them to sort of support somebody who also has a negative view of the city. These are infrastructure problems that they're encountering. There's no social infrastructure. There's no community infrastructure. There's no transit infrastructure. The road infrastructure that's there is bad. There's no, you could think of it as like soft infrastructure, but even like the streetscape. How many retail businesses are there on the street? How easy is it for you to walk along that street? And how does it feel alive? Like, those things are missing, and those are infrastructure questions. We haven't really invested in infrastructure in those parts of the city as much as we should, and we need to, especially, and we are now, around the tower neighborhoods that exist, which is where the poorest people in the city really, really live. Those people, through the Tower Renewal Program, are rebuilding their own neighborhoods and designing the renewal of their neighborhoods. Often, you know, it will be their small businesses that incorporate it, their youth who design the new playground equipment or design the new public space. It's going to take a long time for that to pay off, but people are getting involved. And then sort of, you know, Jane Jacobs articulated certain principles about how the city should function through diversity. And she also, her and the Stop Spadina movement demonstrated exactly how, you know, a reactionary movement, a movement in reaction to things being threatened, can actually go on to do great things affirmatively. And that's what I'm hoping happens next in the story of Toronto. But I think, like, what's key, and I don't know exactly how you get there, but what's key is that I think we need to focus a lot as a city on making the most affordable places in the city better places to live. At the same time, maybe focusing on some of the great places that are widely acknowledged to be the most desirable places to live in the city, making them more affordable. And that's a sort of a separate strategy that could come out of City Hall or somewhere for affordable housing that we haven't really had a decent strategy now for 15 years since Harris and Paul Martin. But we need an affordable strategy for downtown to make those desirable places affordable again. But I think a big part of the missing part of the puzzle is actually continuing and actively working to build the kind of social, community, and physical infrastructure that will make the affordable parts of the city in, northeast Scarborough, in north Etobicoke, in the western part of North York, like, to make those places that are affordable great places to live and that serve their communities well. And
maybe
the people who live in those communities have to really be part of that building. They have to be... Now, you know, I have some suggestions in my book, but I don't have all the answers. Like, it's easy to say, the community I live in has to be involved in the revitalization of my community, that, you know, we need to have an effort. Exactly how to get there is not always easy to answer, right?
Well, one of the most interesting theses in your book, I think, is that you do put down the de-amalgamation movement, which was at least part of the reaction of the core of the former Municipality of Toronto, was that we should just de-amalgamate and we wouldn't have these problems. And it might be partially the onus on those who benefit the most from city services and city affluence to start creating links outside.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting for the links to come from outside in.
The people who I heard talk most about de-amalgamation after Rob Ford was elected, and I think, and especially like after the Jarvis bike lanes were killed, after the Fort York Bridge was killed, and these are like neighborhood issues in the downtown core that are being, you know, dismantled by suburban councillors overwhelmingly, with where the local politicians are always blindsided. But so that de-amalgamation, like, these people do, you know, I don't get these people, and I don't want to be a part of the same city as them. That's the movement that says let's de-amalgamate, right?
And you paint very well.
And I understand it, but it's like we're really talking about like reverse white flight, you know, like now. The de-amalgamation movement, if you look at the maps that show the demographics, I don't think the people who opposed Rob Ford think of themselves as progressive, lefty, like this is the socialists of the city. These are the people who most want to help the poor. But this is the suggestion, is that the richest part of the city should separate and declare its independence from the poor so that we don't have this albatross hanging around our neck, those poor people with their poor anti-bike priorities, and like anti-environmentalist, like rich SUV driving white guy mayor. I mean, that is a puzzle, but like I think that nobody thinks of it that way. Nobody, that's not what's inspiring it, but that's what it winds up being. And I think what's actually a lot healthier, and it's unwieldy and it's difficult, but is that we're a city where rich and poor have always worked with and worked side by side, and that's been one of our strengths, where people of different races, different immigration patterns, like, have always lived in the same neighborhoods, have always been neighbors, and that's part of what's made the city really great. And I think the opportunity we have right now in Amalgamated Toronto is to acknowledge that we still have all of those things within the city, and we need to find a way to continue to work together to make the city stronger so that we're all better off. But it's hard, right? And we have to have a debate. We have to have fight sometimes.
You show very well how Ford can maintain support simply by going out and complaining alongside people. Whereas the people within the core of the city don't seem to want to go out there to even talk about what the problems are. Whereas Ford, who doesn't want to really act on them, but is willing to sit and say, I know how hard it is, will always kind of be able to pitch these two sides of the city against each other.
I mean, there's a danger, too, for me and for everybody. When we talk about these things, we're always generalizing, right? And it's almost by necessity. And there's a danger that I can caricature my friends too much, or the people the people in the downtown core are not, like, you know, snobby, terrible, you know, suburbophobic as a rule, all of them. But the way our debate polarizes, it's hard to see, too, that, yeah, Rob Ford goes out and sympathizes with people. I mean, that's what he's... He goes out and stands beside somebody who's been having a hard time getting City Hall to solve his problem and says, yeah, that sucks. We're going to get a guy over here to see if he can fix it. And I'm going to try and cut your taxes, right? And plus I'm a bumbling moron just like, you know, like, it, no, nobody thinks Rob Ford is outsmarting them, right? Like, nobody does. And that's actually part of his appeal. He's a different kind of politician than the kind of, David Miller was always the smartest guy in the room, and you wanted to follow him. The people who supported him wanted him to lead. They wanted to hear his ideas. And, you know, Rob Ford is kind of like more of a vessel. Everybody knows he's not putting one over on them, not on purpose anyway. He's not scheming, you know. He doesn't seem to be. But what he'll do, too, though, is, like, come in and share your rage with City Hall. But what I'm hoping is that I think I share this a lot of the time, is that there can be a destructive impulse when you feel rage at City Hall or at a bureaucracy or at a corporation or at a block of voters who disagree with you. You sort of have this idea that, like, let's just tear the whole thing down. And now that's been expressed through Rob Ford, and I think we as a city have had a pretty good picture of where the end game of that is, and it's not that pretty. Some of the things we thought should be easy to fix were not easy to fix. Some of the things, you know, And so I think what I'm hoping then is that can be turned. Rob Ford's not going to be turned around, but I think what I'm hoping is that some of the electorate can sort of turn a corner into turning that frustration into, like, a, well, let's fix it, right?
So, Edward Keenan.
Yes.
Thank you very much for spending the time with us.
Oh, thank you.
I think that people got a good sense of what your book, Some Great Idea, is about, and I like how, in this interview and in the book, you end in hope. So it's a great read for history, and it's a great read for an understanding of Toronto and the people that live there throughout. So hopefully more people go out and buy it. And thanks for letting us sit here at the Grid. And
oh, yeah. I'm glad you came to where I work, so it wasn't it's easy for me.
Are there any resources that you want people to know about that they can go to?
In terms of finding me, www.thegridto.com is the website of The Grid magazine, and I blog there a few times a week, as well as my columns and feature stories often about city politics appear there. I am on Twitter at TheKeenanWire. And people can find me on Facebook, too. It's facebook.com/EdwardKeenan.
And we'll put all those on our site as well, which is afterthecollapse.net. And thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks again. Thanks for listening to me talk.
It was fantastic.
Okay.